Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. With me today, back after a while, is Jack Hutchins. Jack, it's great to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
Hey, Michael. Thanks a lot for having me. Great to be back. I've had food poisoning this week, which sucks, but recovering now. And it's always a difficult one because it's a short and an intense illness. And that return to training following that sort of couple of days off is a weird one because you haven't lost any fitness, but you're just feeling a bit empty. So navigating that currently. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. I'm visiting family, so I'm in Finland at the moment. So yeah, it's been good, and I have another week and a bit, but still, it's great to take a break from family and things, and just chat about triathlon. That's always a good break from real life, I guess. Food poisoning is really rough. I honestly, of all the things that are not serious, like, it's probably the worst one, I would say.
Yeah, it definitely felt serious at the time. Yeah. Feel like you want to die.
Yeah.
I'm a bit dramatic. I'm not the best at being ill, I would say. So yeah, it was rough. And my poor partner with our newborn was not too happy that I was just locked in a room, not helping out with the baby. But we got through it. So
she had two babies to take care of instead of one.
Yeah.
I mean, we were discussing before here when at what point we're going to bring in Precision Fuel Hydration as the show partner, but maybe just not to do it now, but make sure that you rehydrate with some electrolytes after that. That's always a good tip after food poisoning.
100%. I was popping the electrolytes for sure. I mean, the difficulty was actually stomaching it. I could barely consume any fluids at all, but when I could, yeah, the electrolytes were a big help.
Yeah. All right, let's get into today's questions. We have a Q&A, and as more of a general information for the listeners, we're planning on doing this about monthly, or really monthly, a Q&A. So yeah, ideally, questions that have more detail and that are a bit more involved, send them in to me whenever you want. I have a document where I store all questions, so you can send them on email at any time, and I'll store them, and we'll bring them up for hopefully the next Q&A or the one after that. But they will all get answered at some point, I hope, unless we get too many questions. But I also put out Instagram stories where I request questions, usually the week that we're recording. So if you follow us there, you will also get a chance to ask questions there. And we'll get to them towards the end of this episode. I'll read the first question here, and we'll get right into it, and then Jack, you can give your thoughts on it. So this one is from Diederik, who's asking, I've noticed that my bike FTP on the trainer and outside are quite different. I first realized this last year when using your intermediate full Ironman training plan, and the range for race effort intervals during long outdoor rides just felt too easy. This year I'm using the intermediate 71.3 plan, and the same thing is happening. What I've been doing is take the top end of the range prescribed by the plan and then add 10 to 15 watts to it. I then monitor my effort levels during the intervals to make sure they match the RPE for those intervals. That approach has worked well for me, but I sometimes wonder, should I be testing my FTP outdoors? But then if my outdoor FTP is 20 watts higher than indoors, would my indoor training become too hard? What approach do you recommend for making adjustments when indoor and outdoor bike FTPs are different?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question, and it's very common, not just from indoors versus outdoors, but maybe from one bike to the next, road bike to TT bike, kind of different conditions even, and different power meters. And I think that, you know, Diederik here, yep. he did a great job, he's kind of on the right tracks by, you know, basically going more to feel, going more to effort, and monitoring his effort levels to make sure the intervals are where they should be. And that's the key, right, is that we're aiming for the right intensity to hit the session objectives, not just a kind of arbitrary number. Even though the number is based on testing and on fact, kind of the FTP or, you know, threshold calculations, whatever you've used to calculate, that number is just a tool in order to get us as close as we can to the target range or the target number. And so when there's other variables, we need to adjust that number accordingly. Because if you think, and as you pointed out, when you're testing in different conditions that the numbers are different, then obviously in training it needs to adjust. I mean, I would check as well just the parameter purely. Are they using the same parameter there? Because could not just be the fact that it's indoor versus outdoor, but it could just be the fact that it is different parameters. Overall, it is normal to see more power outside. I would say that if you're on the same parameter, maybe that's slightly on the higher end of the difference. But I'd say it's still a pretty kind of normal or expected range. Obviously, we want to get that outdoor number as high as possible, because that's what we're going to be, you know, hitting on race day. So it's not necessary that I would try and bring that indoor number up to the outdoor number, but it's better that it's that way around than the reverse. I think it, as I said, it's pretty expected, and I think overall, sticking more to feel and basing your sessions off that in order to hit the objectives is the key. Do you have anything to add there?
I have a few things. I agree, but I think that I agree with everything you said. And the main point there is that I think that the approach you took is the right one, that you just adjust your RPE match, essentially what you want to get out of the session. So I don't. He asks at the end there if he should test both indoors and outdoors. I've never asked an athlete to test both indoors and outdoors. I don't think that that's the way to go. I think that the RPE matching is what makes more sense, because if you test both indoors and outdoors, you would want to do it, let's say, very close to together in the same week or within a couple of weeks, so that you don't have an actual fitness effect that is then confounding what the difference is between the two. But then there's still always day-to-day variability. So how accurate is it going to be? Did you do a good test on one day and a bad test on the other day? So to me, that's not really the way to go. But a few things. One thing that I would say that, I mean, yeah, I think the 20 watts is normal. There's quite a lot of research on this, and in some studies, 20 watts was actually the average that they found. But I think that was from fairly highly trained athletes. So it depends as well on what your FTP actually is. If it's 200 watts, then I would say that, yeah, it's on the high side. Mm. If it's 350 watts, then I would say that, yeah, completely normal that there's a 20 watt difference. But the one thing that I noticed, I don't know if you've seen this as well, but in athletes that have a lower FTP or just generally lower performance indoors than outdoors, for 4 out of 5, I would say, you add a couple of really good fans and most of that difference disappears. Is that something you've seen?
Yeah. Probably don't have enough data points to confirm, but I can see that being true for sure. It's the indoor training environment can be super tough for not just the heat and kind of ventilation reasons, but yeah, I think that's definitely a big factor for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's because a lot of people, they know that they need a fan, so they get one fan, but it's one fan that might be sort of pretty mediocre, or they might get two mediocre fans, or they might get one really good fan. I think you need two good fans. I just think that that's sort of almost more important than a lot of bike upgrades that people make, is if you are somebody that is riding indoors, to maximize what you get out of that training, I think that's something that's really important. There's some science on this as well. There was one study that said that you can actually maintain power output during indoor training up to at least 27 degrees Celsius when humidity isn't too high, if you match the wind speed, the airflow from the fan, to the wind speed that you would generate during outdoor cycling. So that's a pretty hot garage or wherever you have your pain cave, but really the airflow makes such a difference for indoor cycling. So that would be one thing that I would encourage Diederik to look into, if or upgrade his fan setup if he doesn't already have a really good setup.
Yeah, it's a good point. I personally haven't seen quite that same difference. I've experimented with one or two fans, and but it definitely makes a bit of a difference. I think that you made a really good point about the day-to-day variability as well, right? And this is not just, I think, indoor versus outdoor. It's one day to the next, and we should be taking that same approach to the numbers with every session, rather than just indoors versus outdoors, because they're, as you said, that variability is massive based on a number of factors.
Yeah, maybe a better way to go about it, rather than doing a specific test, is to use your actual interval data, at least when you do intervals fairly close to thresholds. So basically intervals that are intended to be FTP intervals or maybe sweet spot intervals. Let's say you have a set of sweet spot intervals and you do those. Sometimes you do them indoors, sometimes you do them outdoors. And indoors you have tested your FTP and it's 300 watts. And then you sort of set your baseline target for sweet spot intervals at 90%, then you would have 270 watts as the target for sweet spot intervals. And of course, as we have talked about, you should adjust that up and down based on how you feel on the day, how you perform on the day. But on average, you might end up around 270 watts across several weeks of training. And if you do those same intervals outdoors and you just RPE match them, like Diederik was doing with his training, and you find that you do 285 watts, and especially if that happens multiple times, or multiple weeks, your average is 285 watts, then you can just back calculate or reverse calculate an estimated FTP from that. So then you would just take, okay, your target for a sweet spot is 90% of FTP. So take 285 divided by 0.9 and you get 317 watts as your outdoor FTP. And then it's based on more data point. But the one thing there that I would say is that you should only do that for training that is fairly close to threshold and ideally at or a little bit below it. So I'd say if you're doing threshold intervals or sweet spot intervals, and maybe between 85 to 105% of FTP, that would be okay. Ideally 85 to 100% to not go above threshold. That's the range where I would maybe do that. But if you go too far away from threshold, then the accuracy of that method would, I think, decrease quite sharply.
Yeah, for sure. No, I like that. I mean, I would say that I think that rate or level of progression is probably quite rare though and unusual, and we shouldn't be looking for that sort of an increase every few weeks, right? That's
no, but I didn't mean
no, I know,
increase. I meant just if he, let's say he has a few weeks of bad weather and he does the same intervals through a 6-week block and he does 3 weeks indoors, or maybe even it's every other week, and the average of the weeks indoors is 300 watts for the intervals and the average for the 270 watts, and the average for the 3 weeks outdoors is 285. So it's not about the improvement, it's about the difference between indoors and outdoors, and you're using the outdoor intervals to back calculate an outdoor FTP.
Sure, yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So next question here.
Yeah.
From Peter. Peter says, is time in zone all that matters for an effective workout, or does it matter how we achieve that time in zone? For example, is there evidence in trained cyclists that 1x30 minutes is more effective than 3x10 minutes? And I've always assumed that the 10-minute intervals needed to be done at a 10-minute power, while the 30-minute interval will be done at a lower 30-minute power. But again, is there evidence that that is required?
Yeah, well, the second question, let's tackle that one first, because I think that one is fairly easy and straightforward. Well, first of all, you actually couldn't repeat your 10-minute power 3 times for 10 minutes. That would be impossible, because then you're not going to recover fully, even if you have fairly long rests from an all-out 10-minute effort. So that's impossible. Of course, you could do 30 minutes at your 30-minute power, but then you're doing a time trial. So, and while that, like some people do that sort of training method, I just don't think that's the most sustainable way of doing it. So the way that I would think about harder sessions, intense sessions, is that you pretty much never want to go to your absolute limit. You want to leave a little bit in the tank. So if you think about it in terms of your session RPE, which is how hard would you rate that session was on a scale from 1 to 10 at the end of the session, or at the end of the main set at least, then usually for a key session, I would say that if you're around 7 or 8, maybe sometimes 6, I mean, 7, I would say, is my baseline, my default, but I'm okay with it going to 8. I'm okay with it sometimes being a 6. That's sort of where I would like to see it. And the occasional 9 can certainly be okay, at least if we're talking about things like higher intensity intervals. But I definitely want to avoid 10s. I would want to avoid all-out efforts in training. So yeah, 7 to 8 probably is the sweet spot for me, I would say, where you want to see that. So basically each session that you're doing, whether it's 1 by 30 minutes or 3 by 10 minutes, you're just trying to solve that that particular session such that you produce a high enough power that you get a good stimulus. You can maintain that power until the end of the session. So if you do those 3 by 10 minutes, you don't want to get slower or get lower power through those intervals. You want to maintain or even slightly increase power in the latter intervals. And if you can do that and then finish the session thinking that, okay, that was pretty hard, but I had a little bit left in the tank, and I made maybe at a 7.5 or an 8 for my session RPE, then I think that's how you should think about it. And yeah, you shouldn't try to hit your maximum powers, because for one thing, it would be impossible for that second example, the 3 by 10 minutes, but also even if it's, you do things like 1 by 30 minutes maximum, it's just not as sustainable in the long term. And you might also actually reduce the amount of total time that you spend at intensity compared to doing slightly less slightly lower intensity, slightly lower effort, but doing more time at intensity, which I guess gets to the next question. So, but before that, thoughts on that part of the question, Jack?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't take this as that he was saying that the 10-minute intervals were at 10-minute max power, but more like they were at his 10-minute rep power, right? Okay. So maybe that's slightly higher than 30-minute power, but it's still,
yeah,
I'm not 10-minute all out, kind of 10-minute max effort power, which I think then ties in nicely to the first question. But yeah, I agree with what you said, especially around the kind of the goals of the workout and how to grade and yeah, the kind of RPE and where we should be following a session and what kind of a load we should be looking at in terms of making it repeatable and aiming for that consistency, basically. Yeah.
Well, that makes, if that is what he asks, that's the harder question then, because then it, and that is the first part of the question, is time in zone all that matters.
Mm.
But then when we say time in zone in this case, are we talking about sort of power zones like Kogan zones, or are we talking about, is 300 watts different than 315? Let's say that he could do 1 by 30 minutes at 300 watts and 3 by 10 at 315 watts. Then that might be the same zone for him. It might be sort of, well, it might be just into the low end of zone 5, but it's not the same power. It's not the same histogram. In a histogram of power, it's not in the same bin. So I would say that, like, if we really are doing things like properly and analyze things with rigor, then those are, that is just like a different time in zone, because the 3 by 10, you actually accumulate 30 minutes at 315 watts rather than 30 minutes at 300 watts, even if they might be in the same sort of arbitrary power zone based on whatever zone system you're using. So in that case, sort of, well, you could almost, yeah, you would have to look at almost discrete power numbers as what you're evaluating. But basically, whether that is all that matters, I think time in zone, like if we take, let's say 300 watts, you're trying to accumulate time at 300 watts, it counts for a lot, regardless of how you do it, whether you do it at, depends on the intensity, of course, but if that's, let's say, close to your threshold, it's high zone 4, whether you do it as 1 40-minute bout or 5 8-minute bouts, then you're still getting a solid stimulus. But I don't think, there's no question that the 1 40-minute bout is going to be more challenging, and especially for certain parameters of your physiology, so your oxygen uptake, your heart rate, and your RPE are all going to be higher when you do it continuously than when you do it as intervals. And so I think that, yeah, does that make sense? First of all, let me, it'll be while I gather my thoughts, you tell me what you think here.
I think you said about the time in zone, and yes, if you're crudely speaking about like a five zone model, then it obviously there's a big range between being at the top or the bottom of the zone. But if we say that we're doing 20 zones, or we just break it down to different powers, then I think it may be good to compare it to, say, kilojoules or something, right? And it's like the goal is yes, in a simple term, time in zones, or how you can get the most work done at kind of different intensities or at a higher intensity. And then the simplest reason for breaking up would be so you can get more of it and at a better quality, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yes, it's not, there's not a massive difference in itself of doing the two, but it's also the fact that can you back it up? What's the quality of it? And over time, that's when the differences would maybe start to present themselves. That being said, I think there is the considerations of the time it takes to get into that zone as well. So if you wanted, say, a VO2 max stimulus, you wanted to be above 90% of VO2 max, and it may take a few minutes of each rep to get into that zone, even with good warm-up. So if you're just doing 1 minute reps with 1 minute recovery at that intensity, it might not necessarily accumulate that much time if that's the session objective, right? It's not to say that's not a good workout, but it just needs to be considered.
Yeah, it accumulates time, and it might accumulate the same time in the power zone, but it doesn't accumulate the same time at a high fraction of your maximum VO2 max. There was a study that did pretty much that. They compared 30 minute continuous versus 30 times 1 minute at the same power. I can't remember the intensity now, but it was the same time in zone and same power output. And obviously, as you might expect, then they showed that the continuous, this was below threshold, I'm pretty sure, though, or at or below threshold. The continuous group spent far more time near VO2 max, and they got a higher lactate. But the intervals, the thing that they had was they used more fast twitch fibers, and probably because of those changes that maybe because of the different VO2 kinetics of different participants, like some people needed to, if they didn't have fast VO2 kinetics, they needed to use more fast twitch fibers when changing to that higher power from the recoveries and so on. So maybe that's more of a, if you want to train the fast twitch fibers without a high-ish power output, maybe that's a reason to do that sort of 30 by 1 minute at a relatively low power. Whereas if you're fairly close to threshold, a 30-minute continuous bout could actually be pretty good for accumulating a long time at close to VO2 max and potentially get a good stimulus to even improve VO2 max. So that was, and there's a whole range of studies that are similar to that. But then what they do is that they basically match. If you match the power, you have the same power. Almost always, the longer reps or the shorter or higher work to rest ratio, you will accumulate a higher time, or you will get higher in terms of oxygen uptake with those longer reps, and you will get a higher RPE. It will feel harder, basically. Lactate varies a little bit depending on the session design, so that's not really clear cut. But yeah, VO2 oxygen uptake and RPE will be pretty consistently, the longer the reps are, the higher you will drive then. But then in the real world, what you're actually doing when you're doing interval training is that you're effort matching things. So like we said at the beginning, if you can do 1 by 30 minutes at 300 watts, then maybe you can do 3 by 10 minutes at 315 watts, and that's sort of your capacity for those two sessions. And then that's a much more interesting question than which one do you go for, and that depends on the goal of the session. But for example, the classic Rønnestad study from 2015 that had the 30-15, so the short intervals, they found a higher time at VO2 max, better improvement at VO2 max, better improvement at 5 minute and 40 minute and 30 second time trial performance compared to the 4 by 5 minute group, even though they had shorter intervals. But that was because they had such tightly regulated sort of 30 seconds on, 15 seconds off. And that was effort matched to the 4 by 5 minute group, which had 2.5 minute recoveries. So same work to rest ratio, but longer, much longer intervals. And then they both worked basically to the best of their ability over 10 weeks. And they found that, yeah, the shorter intervals worked a lot better for most variables they measured there. Or a lot better is maybe, well, significantly better. There was a significant effect. So anyway, when you effort match things and you think about that, yeah, if you have shorter intervals, if you have longer recoveries, then you can push higher power. That's when you start to think about, well, what is the goal of the session physiologically? What is the goal compared to the pure mechanical power output, mechanical pace output, all of those sorts of things. And you try to puzzle things together to achieve your goal for the session, right?
Yeah, for sure. But it's pretty important to say as well that higher, you know, more power is not always better as well, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you have if you're effort matching and you have a super glycolytic kind of athlete, their effort matching is probably going to be overdoing what we want out of that session, especially if we're looking at a sort of sub-threshold tug work or around threshold. And it's, there's definitely more to consider than just what can we maximize in terms of power. And maybe that's where we should look at, more duration as well. And looking, taking a step back, I guess, and seeing how things fit into the bigger picture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the trade-off. Like, the more time in zone you want, or time at a certain power you want, if that is the goal that you're measuring things by. I mean, I would tend to think like this: when you're at or below threshold, time in zone is a very important variable. At threshold is when you start to be in that sort of transition zone to VO2 max training, where time at a high fractional utilization of VO2 max becomes more important, but also potentially just the mechanical stimulus of, depending on your race, especially if you're a cyclist rather than a triathlete, and you have you need to be able to deal with hard surges in your races. That's the other side. But for triathletes, especially for non-draft triathletes, where surges are not a huge part of racing, for amateurs anyway, then above threshold, I would think more about maximizing time at a high fraction of VO2 max. Below threshold, focusing more on maximizing time at a power output. But without going too low either, I don't think that's too low in terms of too short intervals and too high rests. I would put some constraints in there. Basically, this is a minimum duration. This is the minimum work to rest ratio. And then at threshold, if you train right at or right around threshold within a sort of narrow band there, then you might actually think about both of those factors at the same time. So for example, this was a study we talked about recently with Gabriele Gallo in the research roundup I did a couple of episodes ago with the Ingvild Odden. She did a study where they took a group of athletes that did a session of 5x8 minutes at their 40-minute TT power. And so they all did the same sort of performance intensity, let's say. But it ended up being 40-minute TT power was a higher or lower fractional VO2 max for different athletes. And those athletes for whom it was a higher percentage of VO2 max, or more specifically, during those sessions, they were closer to VO2 max. They accumulated a higher percentage of time close to VO2 max. They improved more on basically all metrics, including VO2 max, including power at 4 millimoles. I think they measured it, and time trial performance. Probably can't remember exactly what all the outcome measures were, but they measured quite a lot of things. Oh, the performance index as well, I think they measured there, which is a combination of different time trials and. Anyway, yeah, so I can't remember where I was going with that, but at threshold or around threshold, that is probably 40-minute TT power, right around critical power, you would say. There you can have the point there being that at least if your critical power is not too low compared to your VO2 max, you can have a significant impact on your VO2 max also at that intensity. So then you can think of both maximizing time in zone because you want to have that improved time to exhaustion at threshold, that improved muscular endurance, if you will, but you can also have that stimulus for your VO2 max at that intensity.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, I would also question when looking at some of these things, some of the research, what's the effect on long course triathlon as well? Because I think it's always hard to, or I don't think they apply as well as the research maybe says sometimes.
That is a fair point. I think this was a cyclist asking because I cut quite a bit of the question, but I'm pretty sure he's a cyclist. And I also cut the bit where actually this is maybe important context, where he basically asked if it's okay to just, you go out and do a ride and you ride hard on your hills on that course or that loop that you have. So that was a bit where the question came from. If you accumulate, let's say, 40 minutes of work at critical power and it's spread out. And I think that this is where, for example, the discussion I had with Colin Moore some weeks ago, like he saw the opinion. And I kind of agree that if you do longer VO2 max intervals, you can spread them out throughout the ride, because within each of them, you will still spend quite a large chunk at a high fractional utilization. That doesn't work when the intervals get too short, though.
Yeah.
And I also think when it's threshold intervals, same thing there. I think that you need to get to a sort of the muscles need to be challenged within each interval for that to work. So then it can work if the threshold intervals are long enough, like maybe you're doing 15 minutes at threshold. But if you're doing 4 minute threshold intervals, then I would do it in a tight set with tight recoveries rather than spread it out with large chunks of recovery in between.
100% agree. And what kind of duration reps would you give for those sort of save VO2 reps if they're breaking them up versus threshold reps if they're breaking them up?
Do you mean if they spread out throughout the ride?
Exactly. If someone wanted to do some VO2 session spread out and a threshold session spread out.
I would give four to 5 minutes for VO2, 4 minutes minimum. But yeah, either 4 or 5 minutes and I would say is what I always would do. And I sometimes give those sessions. And for threshold, probably depends on how much the athlete is struggling with holding power at threshold. But yeah, at the absolute minimum, 10 minutes. Otherwise, I wouldn't bother. But ideally, I would probably be more like 15 minutes.
Yeah, nice. No, agreed. I think you could even stretch out the reps a little bit as well. Longer than that.
Even longer. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you can do that, I would absolutely go for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, now it's probably, to be honest, if 10 minutes is struggle, it might imply a slightly overestimated threshold anyway. So
yeah,
it wouldn't really be an issue.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's like more challenging to mentally to get your head around doing this long a rep at VO2 max or at threshold power. But then in another way, actually pushing on hills is always easier, right, as well?
Yeah.
So it makes it, in a way, it's not sometimes being 50 minutes at threshold on a climb is a lot easier than doing it on a flat as well. So if you're just looking purely at sort of output there, it's in terms of if we're looking at specificity though, then maybe we should look at the timing of those workouts and as well, I mean, bigger picture, but yeah.
So where would you do those workouts? Would you do that farther away from racing and closer to racing? You would bring things closer and make it make it intervals with shorter rest so that you simulate more closely that long block of sustained intensity that you would have in a race.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that being said, it depends on the race, right? Sometimes we've got hilly races where you are having to do big reps, big hills with big descents, then maybe you have more of an argument for doing that. But I think most races are not like that. Even if they're rolling, you're still pretty much on the power or on the pace, aren't you, for prolonged periods. So, and also a big part of it is holding position as well. And if you're on a climb, then you're not necessarily going to be holding an aerial position. So that's where you got to be careful doing all your work up a climb.
Right. Let's move on to the next question. This one is from Daniel, who asked, 2 weeks ago, I did my first 7.3 distance race, which went really well for me. And I finished it 30 minutes faster than my goal time. During the race, I had two things I'm trying to wrap my head around. Number one, I prepared okay for the swim with 2x45-minute swim workouts per week with different intensities over the last 6 months. There were around 600 starters, and compared to other races I did, the fighting during the first part of the swim was okay. But after a start, I wasn't able to breathe properly and do my preferred three strokes breathing. So breathe every three strokes. I had to breathe every second stroke, and it took me nearly three quarters of the swim to get to a normal rhythm. Do you have any clue why that happened? Could that be due to nervousness, the cold, the wetsuit, because it was my first race with a wetsuit? Or was it just that I'm not experienced enough? Let's take this part first, and then we can do the second part after.
So the first part was...
So this whole thing, the swim.
Sorry. Yeah. I'm with you. He kind of answered the question there in a way himself. I think the biggest aspect probably was the nervous race nerves. I would say your breathing is elevated before the start. It's a foreign environment. As I said, he's just been training in the pool, 600 people around you. You're not going to be able to mimic that on race day. So he ultimately just doesn't have the experience in that sort of environment, and it's one of those things that no matter how confident or good of a swimmer you are, if you're not used to being in that sort of position, then you're gonna have to kind of experience some anxiety, right? And so that's gonna cause that increased breathing rate, that you're maybe rushing your inhalation while you're swimming, so therefore you need to breathe more frequently. And you can't do your normal breathing every three. He didn't say the temperature, I believe, in there.
But no, he didn't.
That also could be a factor, right? It's a known recognized phenomenon that you get cold water on your face, and that's going to increase the breathing rate as well. And yes, the wetsuit as well could have an impact. There's all sorts of things, and he limited open water experience. And yeah, ultimately, you need to get involved with a bit more open water swimming, and even just more racing to get used to that. I think perhaps maybe visualization, or just taking a moment to stop in the race and just reset could help. It's a super normal thing, and it's... I think a lot of people have experienced something similar. But I think just managing your intensity as well is probably another good approach, where you take a step back and just swim a little bit easier. That just ultimately usually doesn't affect your speed too much, but it just allows you to be a little bit smoother. And if you can manage your breathing rate through that, then you're probably going to swim faster with better efficiency, better technique as well. Yeah, I mean, I didn't have anything more to add really than that. Do you have anything?
A couple of things. Although my internet is now... Can you still hear me? Because my... Now it's back, because I froze for a moment there, it seemed like. So I think in addition to what you said, there can be a bit of a negative feedback loop there when you... Mm-hmm. Whether it's because of the cold shock, or because of the anxiety, or because of the wetsuit, you start to hyperventilate and lose control of your breathing, generally speaking, then it's hard to get out of, because then usually when you feel out of control, you're not really focusing on it, you stop exhaling properly, and then you get a CO2 buildup as well. Mm-hmm. And CO2 buildup, hypercapnia, that then leads to that feeling of breathlessness and feeling that you need to breathe even more, which can lead you to lose focus even more of the exhalation. So I think that when you have, whatever the reason is, whether it's of all those possible reasons or a combination of all of them, a reset, like you said, can be really good. And doing that reset, focusing on exhalation, you might not need to stop. You can just, if you can break out of that lack of control of your breathing, if you can take back control and focus on really proper exhalation, you might get things back in control, because you can expel that CO2. Reduce that sort of air hunger, and then gradually get back into your normal stroke and your normal breathing patterns. The other thing that I would add just is that with the wetsuit itself, since it was the first race, he said, he didn't say if he had tried it in training, so that's unclear, but he definitely said it was the first race. Especially if it's a pretty snug wetsuit, then that can really put a lot of pressure on the chest and feel quite uncomfortable. one trick that you can use is to put a bit of water in there through the front, and that can sort of break that feeling of suffocation almost. So that's something that I would recommend. And with a cold shock, actually, I know some people don't like it because they feel like it depends on how long you have to wait on the beach. I always like to get in the water. The colder it is, the more I want to get in it before, because I get terrible cold shocks when I first get in cold water. So even if I have to stand freezing on the shore, I would much prefer to get in the water before the race, get that cold shock over with, then stand and freeze a bit on the beach before the race starts. And then at least when I get in the water again, I don't get that cold shock. But if obviously a lot of races don't allow getting into the water, so then just try to get some water in a water bottle or something, cold water from the ocean, and pour it over your face and try to get that cold shock over with that way. That's another trick that you can use. And I think that other than that, you mentioned everything that I wanted to talk about with regards to the swimming issues that he had. So let me read the next part, the bike part. So Daniel writes, the bike was quite hilly with 1,300 meters of altitude. I guess he means elevation gain here. After around 70 kilometers, both my hamstrings started cramping during the uphill. Was it due to altitude? Was it bad preparation? Even though I felt prepared with a few good outdoor hilly rides during training? Or was it lacking carbs or sodium? I had a gel before the swim and every 30 minutes on the bike, and I also had some isotonic drink.
I mean, cramping is mainly due to fatigue, right? But obviously then hydration status is also a big factor. If we address the hydration side of things first, you definitely want to be looking at that fluid and electrolyte intake. From the limited information here, I think it sounds like he wasn't taking enough on.
It's hard to say because he just doesn't. Well, he says
just having some isotonic.
Yeah,
drink.
It sounds a bit low, but it could just be very precise. Yeah.
I mean, from that, it doesn't. At least not thought out, right? And I think, I mean, this is where I would go to our sponsor, actually, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They have a
fuel and hydration planner.
Planner, exactly. And it's an amazing tool, honestly, where you can input your race duration and all of your kind of individual metrics, and it takes all of that information and the race, and then it spits out a plan with some specific numbers to work towards. Did you want to add anything on the precision stuff before I go on?
They also have great articles about how to actually test your sweat rate.
Yeah.
So the fuel hydration planner will give you an estimate for sweat sodium concentration, but you can test your sweat rate yourself with just a scale at home, and they have articles and spreadsheets for that you can use. Obviously, you don't necessarily need that, but it's very helpful. And that's the main thing regarding that. I also want to say that I've got my hands on some of their newest product, the watermelon chews, which are like all of their chews. It's just like candy. But it's honestly like so good. So try them out if you haven't. If you haven't tried the chews in general, you should try them. But the watermelon chews now are my current favorites there. So check them out and use the code DTS2026 to get 15% off your order.
I think they're sold out though, Michael. So listeners might be out of luck there. That's how good they are, but keep an eye out.
Yeah.
I mean, and then so I think also just to say on cramping, I mean, you see a lot of top athletes that cramp in major races, right? And even in kind of races where they've had good results. And you look at maybe, I think Christian Blumenfeld is probably one of the most famous examples where he's finished on the podium in big races while still cramping. And I think this is the, it's kind of the line that we're riding. When you're on the river, you're almost, we're playing with fire in terms of that fatigue and some cramping is not, we want to try and avoid it, but it doesn't mean that the race is over, right? I've actually cramped in some of my best races, and it's probably just from, over biking slightly or missing some kind of hydration because of the way the race is played out. But you can sort of come back from that, and it's not game over completely. I would say that if you're talking about this race specifically and going back to, is it Daniel?
Yeah,
Daniel's question here. The elevation gain, if you've not conditioned to that can be a factor because potentially the mechanics are slightly different if you've just ridden all on flat, and that's something to consider. But I think mainly the fact that it's race day, you're pushing harder than you ever pushed before, and you're going to be kind of riding that line a little bit. So it's something that we need to continuously be thinking about no matter your level. And even if we can do everything we can to prevent it, but it's not something that you address once and then that's it. You've sorted it and you never have to think about it again, really.
Yeah, I think the Christian Blumenfeld example is a great one for this context because if we think about, it might have happened several times, but the one I'm thinking of is in the PTO US Open a few years ago. Yeah. And what happened there was that he had changed his bike fit the night. First of all, he hadn't been riding a lot on a TT bike at all, I think, because he was when they were trying to, or they went back to the Olympics that year. And then he also changed his bike fit something like the night before the race, right? So, and even if it was a small change, that means there's a slightly different biomechanics, meaning slightly different demands on the muscles that you haven't prepared for in training. And then when you have muscular demands that are different mechanically, metabolically, that you haven't prepared for, then that always increases your chances of cramping. And I think the amount of elevation here, even if he says that he had been doing some good hilly training rides, did they really match the amount of climbing that you did in the race? Or was it perhaps that you did a lot of rolling hills, but the race had a lot of sustained climbs because that's quite different as well. And did you ride when you in training? Did you ride that at actual race intensity on the climbs, or did you not do so much race intensity training? So, yeah, there's a lot of different boxes there that you need to check really to make sure that you're physically well prepared to not cramp. But I would also lean towards that. At 70 kilometers into a middle distance race, dehydration can certainly predispose you to be more likely to cramp. But I think the main factor is some kind of fatigue or an overload. Let's put it that way. You haven't prepared, or you're not prepared for the demands that you're asking your body to perform. And in a race like this with a lot of climbing, that can be a typical one, I think, that goes wrong, that you might have done a lot of training, but it wasn't the right type of terrain. Maybe you don't have those long climbs, if it was a race with long climbs, and that's a case where I would say that actually you need to go and simulate that course on an indoor trainer, go on Ruby, and if it's an Ironman, it's made on 3, then you have them on Ruby. But you can, regardless of which race it is, you can ride on the indoor trainer, and you can put yourself in a fixed power, fixed cadence that you know that you'll be facing on race day. You obviously have some idea of what gearing you'll be using and what the gradients are. And because I think it's not just about the power, it's also about the torque. If the climbs on race day are a lot steeper than the ones that you've been training at, and you're suddenly doing a lot higher torque than you used to do because you're running out of gears, then that's also something that's going to be, basically your body's not prepared for that, because while you have done it, you have done the power, you have done the elevation, but you haven't done the torque. So there's quite a few factors there to consider.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's some good points. I think Christian as well, though, going back to him, I think Jan Frodeno did get in his head for that race, right? And he overbiked is not just the position. And I think, but you're right, the position as well has a big impact. I think, and ultimately what we said earlier about you don't want to be going right to the well in training. So the race is where we test and where we kind of find our limits more so than we would on race day. And you can prepare all you like, but the race day, you're pushing harder than you ever pushed before, because that's the nature of a race. So it's, these things tend to present themselves. And it's not necessarily the fact that things have gone incredibly wrong or the preparation has been suboptimal.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we, even though you did start to talk about the hydration side of things, we spent most of the time here talking about the physical preparation. And but I do want to emphasize that if this is a person that sweats a lot and has a high sodium concentration especially, then that could have a pretty big contributing factor. So
yeah,
so I think it is important homework for you, Daniel, to check that. You don't need to do I think the online estimation of your set sodium concentration is usually good enough for most purposes, unless you have like consistent issues. So do that and then measure your sweat rate at home. And this way you can potentially rule out that as a factor, or you can say that, oh, well, actually that was likely the cause because I have such a high sweat rate and high sodium concentration. So yeah, I just wanted to bring that up as well, just because we did spend a lot of time on the other factors, the physical preparation and fatigue and, overload type factors. We have one question here about MLSS, but I think we're running relatively low on time, given that we also have a lot of questions that we got from Instagram. So what do you say about we leave the MLSS question for our next Q&A and we jump straight to the Instagram questions?
Let's do it. So I'll take the first one here from Bandrike.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that's. Any recommendations to help open the hips/glutes up in a TT position prior to a race? It can usually take me 10 to 20 minutes to find power during a race, it seems.
Oh, Jack, you won't believe this, but I didn't realize that these were the same question because they were sent in two different cards. I have added them and I didn't even see that it was the same person asking. So, so I have answered them as two completely different questions. So I'm being put on the spot here. Well, I mean, open up, do you know that it's opening up the hips, glutes, that is the reason that it takes you 10 to 20 minutes to find power? So my answer, when I was just thinking about, I saw the question, it can usually take me 10 to 20 minutes to find power during a race, it seems. It wasn't really a question, but I filled in the blanks. My bullet points that I noted down were: try to increase your kicking in the last few minutes of the swim to get blood flow to the leg. Also, try to start the bike at a higher cadence for the same reason, try to get quick blood flow quickly to the legs. And the third one would be actually try a caffeine gel before the swim. So those were my points there. If you think that it's opening up the hip glutes, yeah, I mean, I wrote the world's greatest stretch, which is a good sort of single dynamic movement that works on the hips and glutes, among other things, thoracic rotation, etc. So that's a good one to have, just one to recommend, and would probably be helpful for the swim as well. But I'm wondering if it's could it be a wetsuit fit thing potentially or something like that. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, is he talking about triathlon or is he just talking about an open TT?
That is a good question.
I'm not saying either way, but the answer is different because then the wetsuit doesn't impact things.
If he's talking about the pure TT and it takes him 10 to 20 minutes, then the answer is just a good warm up, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Give it to Saul.
Then it's an easy answer. But maybe some, you said about the world's greatest stretch. I'm not actually familiar with that one, but just some activation work, maybe posterior chain type stuff, just to kind of get things going pre-swim or pre-race. The other thing when I was looking at this, I was like, well, actually, is it the worst thing in the world if it takes you 10 to 20 minutes to find your power during a race? Even in a TT, it depends on the length, but especially if you're talking about triathlon here, like, often the biggest mistake people make is going out too hard, right? So yes, it takes you 10 to 20 minutes to find your power or kind of get into things, but ultimately that could be setting you up well for a good day on the bike and run. So depending on if it's open TT versus a triathlon, I'd be looking at that. But I think my answer, is basically what you said, as as well as in addition, maybe some more race simulation type thing in training, just to go through that race day routine with the wake up, the caffeine, as you said, just fine tune that routine to with, you know, everything in terms of wake up times and all of that sort of stuff to make sure you are awake and ready to go and have a play with different factors there, warm-ups, nutrition, caffeine, and just to get you going, basically.
It would be helpful to know how he feels his swim is going, if he has any problem getting into that from that perspective. But actually, that leads me to one final point, and which is how he paces the swim. Like, if he really overdoes it on the swim, and
yeah,
I'm saying this from personal experience. Like, if you really like go as hard as you can on the swim, maybe you've probably been in that situation too, I presume, but you go quite acidic at the end, and at least for up to middle distance, you have a lot of lactate and you go pretty deep. I think that really can impact your bike power, and it takes time to really basically reset a bit more to baseline, because you've gone so intense on the swim.
100%. And also T1, I would add to that. It's like you swim hard and then you go to standing and swim, run hard through T1. That's what really can set you on the back foot on the bike.
Yeah. So maybe another thing to try is to actually slow down a bit in the last part of the swim, the last 5 minutes, and then take T1 fairly controlled. All right. Let's see the next one, which is from Christoph, who asks, concept of raising the ceiling with VO2 max block followed by threshold blocks, silver bullet.
Yeah, good question. Silver bullet, as in he's saying, is this
a silver bullet?
No, I'd say there isn't a magic order. And in general, I guess the kind of accepted philosophy is that we're being more specific with the intensity focus as we get closer to the race, right? So the order is maybe dictated by that. He says here the VO2 block followed by the threshold block, but I wouldn't start with a VO2 block either. You need to be fit enough to get the most out of that block. So you could have, say, more of a technical or block, then a volume block, then a threshold block, then a VO2 block, then a race specific block or something like that. Or any, as I said, there's not a magic order, but that's maybe a sort of a way I would approach it, crudely speaking.
Yeah, I think it's not a silver bullet, but I definitely think that it's something that can work well. But in general, I actually think that we probably overrate sequencing of different blocks. And I think that you could probably do it either way, or you could do it like not even make it a block periodization, but do one VO2 session and one threshold session per week for a longer time and have similar outcomes. So I think that the main thing, I think block periodization helps you get, it helps you get an easy overview of what you're planning to do and what type of training you're getting in at different times of year. But it helps, but the reason that that's helpful, I think, is not because the sequence is so important, but it makes sure that you don't completely miss or get very limited amounts of certain types of training that are helpful for you. So it's easy to overview in that sense. And I think that that's where, one of the ways it's helpful. And getting in both VO2 max and threshold training over the course of the season, I think, is important. But I don't see the particular sequence as of major importance. But I also, I'm absolutely not against using this sequence that he's proposing. So, yeah.
So next question here is from CSOF Antum. Should one train after a tooth operation / implant, or is it okay to take 1 week off as an age group?
No weeks off. No, you really need to listen to your dental surgeon here. I think, at least I'm not speaking for myself, I'm not qualified to answer that question, and I think it's going to be specific to your situation. But I would guess it's likely to take, depending on how big an operation it is, it's likely to be at least a couple of days. So recommending no training, at least that's from my limited experience with wisdom teeth having them removed.
Are they mostly done under general anesthetic, I assume?
Local.
Local. So, yeah. I mean, I think that makes a difference, right? If you're going under completely, then that's definitely the probability of a week. But if it was local, I mean, as I said, listen to your dentist, but I think you could probably, a week's, I wouldn't expect to need that much of. My general rule for recovery, obviously timing is completely varied, but, you know, rest, refuel, easy training first, then you can add a bit more volume, and then you can add intensity kind of in that order. The timings, obviously, you're listening to the professionals, but yeah.
And about the anesthetic, it's a bit beside the point, but in my case, it was local because it was only one. But I know that if they had taken two at the same time, she said that it would have been general. So,
sure.
So, and I guess, I don't know if that would apply for an implant as well. So, but yeah, I think the points you made are very good. My question is, this one is from James Goodman, who asks, is 120 grams of carb best consumed through 3 by 40 grams or 4 by 30 grams?
This is really splitting hairs, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe, probably doesn't matter too much. I mean, maybe the 4 by 30 gives more opportunities to absorb, because it's a slightly less of a large dose at once and in the stomach at once. Maybe that's a little bit less risk of just having some discomfort. But I mean, my approach is you fuel when the race allows it, right? If you have time to be less aero or less time, you know, less pressure on the pedals where you can absorb things, then you want to be led more by that than specific kind of plans, and you're still trying to hit the numbers per hour. But the actual how that is made up, then I don't think it matters too much. That being said, some people are very, very sensitive, and so that maybe you would take more of a priority and more care over exact timings. Just the key is practice in training what you're planning to do, and then you know hopefully how you're going to respond.
Yeah. We actually talked a little bit about this with in my recent interview with Paul Booth, where basically he said that there is some evidence that consuming carbs 3 to 4 times per hour is better than doing it less frequently, but also than doing it too frequently. So, for example, if you were to take 10 grams every 5 minutes, so 12 times 10 grams in an hour to get the same amount, that might reduce carbohydrate oxidation from the exogenous carbohydrate. I haven't looked up that, so I haven't seen it, but I know he said it, and I looked it up before in my notes and my preparation for this episode, so I know that he said it. That being said, though, on the bike, especially in the triathlon, I think we tend to consume things from a bottle quite often, and it often is in more those smaller chunks. Yeah. I think that you can also, probably... to some extent, you can train yourself to at least tolerate it, whether it reduces oxidation. Perhaps it does. But I think that, like, the top of the hierarchy, or the most, like, let's say, the most important thing in the hierarchy is, like you said, you need to fuel when the race allows it and when it's not going to be detrimental, at least especially if you're in a race with group dynamics and things like that. But also, like, if you're on a technical downhill, that's not the moment to fuel anyway. So yeah, that's at the top of the hierarchy.
Yeah, good points.
Now it's your question, right?
Yep. So from Matif Znuna, apologies for the pronunciation. It's an Instagram handle, so maybe that's not possible to say smoothly. Your thoughts on the timing of training different physiological qualities throughout the ATP and your training plan? Thank you.
Oh, you said it kind of. You said less. Paraphrasing a bit, you said less specific to more specific. That's kind of how I approach it before.
Yeah.
In a different context. And we also talked about this in quite some detail in our base training series. So I'd encourage, because this is a big question.
Yeah.
But the short answer for me is generally less specific to more specific.
Yeah, no, good answer. I mean, always aerobic as well for me, in a way. Yes. That's still number one for everything, but yeah.
Let's see one quick question, and we have a few more that we can save for next time. And this one is from Christina Krast, who asks, how to train for Nice's climb in the UK, where we have no long climbs?
Yeah, good question. I think we could signpost them to Ruby for this one, maybe.
Yeah, it's on there. The full course is on there.
There we go. Yeah, that's a great place to start. Or, but I would also say with this kind of specificity, it goes back to what you just said as well, right? Is the priority should be just getting as fit as possible and focusing on what is needed to do that rather than trying to stress about doing specific sessions up climbs. And you know, that is really the cherry on top of the cake. But yeah, when the time comes, then reusing Ruby. If you're on flat roads there, you can kind of match the power profile of the race that you expect, that you maybe have calculated from best bike split or something, and then match that to flat roads. That's works pretty well as well. Obviously, you might not have the actual mechanics of riding up and down a climb. So there you could actually just ride up and down a climb, a shorter climb, in order to get some sort of specific conditioning to be in a bit more out of the saddle. If you match the elevation that you're accumulating, it's not the same as going up and climbing for 30 minutes given, but it's still you're still getting some time in that sort of similar position. So it goes some way to addressing that.
Yeah. I know you have a call in a couple of minutes, so I'll be really quick here with just a couple more things. I think just do some pre-planning, think about the power that you can hold up the climb and your gearing so that you have an idea of what cadence you'll be holding, so that you can at least, you can assess whether you need to do some low cadence work or not. You might not need to do that if you're able to hold your normal cadence up the climbs. But like we talked about in the other question, if lower cadence is going to be part of your race, then that is something that you should practice. And the main point is training for climbing is easy. It's the descent that is harder. So I would try to, where you can, find short descents that have some just general technical elements to improve your general technical and cornering skills. It doesn't have to simulate the course. Yeah, you can obviously get the video, you can get the feel for it on Ruby, but the actual cornering, the actual skill, you have to do outdoors. And so I'd find take whatever you can find and use that to practice for that descent and for those corners. It's not hugely technical. There are some, I know Christina has been with us in Mallorca. In Mallorca, there are a lot of descents that are much more technical. So the Nice course, I would say, is more like going down called the Femenia, which is a very non-technical descent with nice flowy corners. There are a couple of hairpins in the Nice course, but not too much. But yeah, we're running out of time or coming against time here, so let's wrap it up. Thank you to everybody for listening. Like I said, we'll be doing this monthly going forward, so send in your questions. Longer questions are best sent on email, michael@scientificcraftland.com, and that's Michael with a K. And also remember that if you're enjoying the show, we would love to hear your feedback. Leave your comments on Spotify, on YouTube, and both in the episode poll or on Spotify. And we read all of that and we take your feedback seriously, and it's important to us. So please do that. It helps us, and we appreciate you. And that's it. Thank you, Jack. It was great to have you back, and see you again soon.
Thank you, Michael. See you soon.